Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Write Club. The first rule of Write Club is you don't talk about Write Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello and welcome back to Write Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. I'm Teresa and today I'm joined by Pat, Heather and Linda.
Hello.
Hi.
We're all wearing our big girl pants because we're here without our technical guru Nicola and our administrative wizard Stephanie, but we're going to do our best. Today we're focusing on reading and in particular on the therapeutic benefits of reading. Nicola will be sharing something very different for her current work in progress and we'll be giving her some feedback or trying to. Heather and Amy Lee Tempest will be telling us what's on their bedside tables and Stephanie will be sharing a nugget of wisdom or some other sort of nugget. But first, Linda will ask us to
name the novel.
So are you all ready? Pencils sharpened?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yep.
This book was first published in 2003 and reprinted in 2004. It's a novel set in both the past and the near future, before and after the collapse of a society run by monopolist corporations and unchecked genetic engineering.
Ooh.
No.
Doesn't ring any bells.
Brave New World.
2003.
No. Oh, right.
Why are you guessing already?
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, clue two. This is the first book of a trilogy. The protagonist, who may be the last human, journeys through a dystopian future looking for answers in what is now a hostile world.
I don't. It's not what I bring down.
He must contend with primitive humanoids, massive hybrid pigs that grow human organs to be used as replacements for the wealthy.
You've got us all frowning. No.
Clue three. The author rejects labeling it as science fiction. She has described it as speculative fiction. And adventure romance rather than science fiction because it does not deal with things we can't yet do or begin to do and goes beyond the amount of realism she associates with the novel form.
I have no idea at all.
I had The Road in my head.
Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah, Cormac McCarthy. No. But when you said she, that's why I smacked myself around the head. Yeah.
Oh, I thought for one glorious minute that it was Hitchhiker's Guide.
No.
Or The Hunger Games.
No.
Briefly, but then no.
Okay. No. For those of you out there who always get this, I hope you have good luck. It's Oryx and Crake by Margaret Atwood.
Right.
Oh.
I see.
And what was the name of it?
Oryx and Crake, C-R-A-K-E, by Margaret Atwood.
Well,
so I was, I'm terribly surprised because...
They're very topical.
I know that you all love Margaret Atwood and I thought you...
haven't read that one.
No, I don't know that one at all. Well done, you got us.
Oh,
well
done. Wonderful.
Thanks, Linda. Okay, let's hear from Nicola.
I cling tight to the bridge, the wind howling around. Cars roars just above, but I can't hear a sound because the pain in my heart screaming louder than loud. Looking down, water glints, diamond stars on dark night. It's supposed to hurt bad, concrete laid on its side. Glinting love in your mother's eyes, right on her side, when she begs you to stop. Tonight, stay inside. But you don't listen. You never listen. You don't hear the spell that could break open the night where your personal hell, because your ears hear no sound, because the pain in your heart screaming louder than loud. Siren wail, someone called them when I wouldn't come down. I hear people shout, but I have a good plan. The first in my life to becoming a man. No gang made me do it, no girl laughed her way through it. But I don't listen, I never listen. I don't hear the spell that could break open the nightmare, my personal hell, because my ears hear no sound except the pain in my heart screaming louder than loud. I did well at school, but I can't get me no job. Still home with four brothers, sharing a room like animals. One sister is gone just to breed for a man. One is walking the street to get her next fix, saying, hey baby, hey baby. But you don't listen, you never listen. You don't hear the spell that could break open the nightmare, your personal hell, because I watch and can't help. My ears hear no sound except the pain in my heart screaming louder than loud. Lights rake my face keen while blinding my eyes. Arms shake with the cold, but I'm ready to fly. I empty my thought of all thoughts of the others. One less means much more for my siblings and mother. Who knows, ears hear no sound, except the pain in my heart screaming louder than loud, because she hears it too, but she's braver than me. She carries on.
Wow. That was definitely something different from Nicola. And I have to say, I so admire her courage.
Wonderful, wonderful.
She will try anything. She is really, really, she gets excited about something and she just dives right in.
She's absolutely fearless. Yeah. So where do we start to critique this?
We talked last week about writing songs, and I said, for me, a song lyric is essentially a poem.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I think you start with it as poetry to a certain extent, in the same way that you'd critique a poem. And so you...
But isn't that cheating a little bit?
Why?
You know, to just looking at it on the page rather than responding to the performance and critiquing that and the fact that the music is there. If you're just looking at the text, you're kind of ignoring the whole context. Mm. Maybe?
Well, I think that would certainly be true for rap music. Mm. Because you really need, I think, to have that beat and know, because I noticed if you're reading it, it looks like some of the lines are have too many syllables to really fit in. But when you listen to her do it, it's not such a problem. So I think it does need to be.
But I want a video or a live performance.
Ask her to make a video if she can bear to do it all again.
Yes, yes.
But, that'll be the next thing. She'll
post it on the.
She'll be all over YouTube, but internet sensation.
I don't see why not.
Going viral.
Yes. Well,
having said, you know, I think it's brilliant. I really think, you know, she's put herself into this mindset, this imaginary scenario, and imagined a whole backstory, which she kind of just gives you little hints and clues to think about.
Right.
But I also, I do think, should middle-aged, middle-class white women rap? Because she's got such lovely diction.
Yes.
Diction. And then she does things, except the pain in my heart, and it doesn't sound quite right. Yeah. Can't get me no job. Or whatever. No, it doesn't sound right. So I think, I don't know, you've got to either use your own voice or be wholeheartedly into that persona.
Yes, I do think it's the poshest rap.
Well, I think it would be wonderful now that we're talking about it, if we started a whole other genre of rap, it would be white women. White women of a certain age rapping.
Well, maybe that'll be the next project for Write Club. we'll start performance.
Or the next craze.
Spoken word performance rapping. Fabulous.
No, she performed it, but it's like you say, if you write a song and you might have to do a demo disc, you're not necessarily putting that, your demo disc, out there as publish this because this is me singing my song. You're showing a producer, publisher or whatever, this is the song, this is kind of how it sounds.
Yeah.
So to me, I sort of see this as Nicola sort of doing a demo of a rap that's not necessarily intended as her product.
It's not. But, yes, I see what you mean. It's not the finished product. It's right. showing it's, how it might be performed.
A right person might present
and,
it.
And she mentioned, I think, a website, didn't she, mm-hmm. where she had gone to learn about how to put wrap together, etc. Mm-hmm. So I think that'll probably show up on our Facebook.
Yeah, when I do the links, I will share those things because as Nicola says, you can find out how to do anything on the internet.
That's
these
true.
Days, you know, including fiberglassing a boat is one that I've done. But I do think it's a great performance, a great product, and the ideas and the thought and the structure of it.
I still think that the poetry comparison is valid because you do need to still be looking at scansion and rhyme and rhythm and so on. And if a line jars, yes, with the sort of the backbeat and so on, it works. But odd occasions, there's a little bit of a as there would be if it was just spoken.
Right. Not being terribly familiar with rap, although I have listened to some because I really wanted to know what it's about. And I was, frankly, very positively impressed because I think that much of what I listened to was very expressive and trying to put across some of the feelings that especially these young black men who are rapping are feeling in our society and our culture, and I thought they were doing a wonderful job of doing that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, and I listened to some that was full of obscenities, and I didn't really like because I didn't think that they were honestly from the heart talking about the things in society that that upset them or other things, even love or whatever. But I liked it. I liked what it did. I wish that on Nicola's recording here, it would have been, if her voice had been louder, it would have been better, more clear. But I guess that didn't happen. But I still was able to hear it all. It's just
as I say, she has very good diction. It was all very clear.
And I could just picture her sitting there rapping, Actually, her son raps, right?
Yes, exactly. She's more imbued in that culture than we are. She's closer to it. And she's worked in the music business, so she's quite up to date.
More so than me.
Anyway.
Yeah.
Well done, Nicola. You've given us a rare treat there.
That's right, yeah.
Okay, and now we're going to hear from Stephanie.
Well, I came across this book called Unfortunate English, which was the gloomy truth behind the words you use, and I just found it quite fascinating. And I'll give you an example. If someone's ever called you pretty, has anyone ever called you pretty?
No.
Well, you think you're pretty clever? Anybody said that? Okay.
Yeah.
Very clever.
Good. Okay. Well, you might think it's all these pretty things are complimentary, right?
Yeah.
But actually, no. Because pretty originally meant artful, crafty, or cunning.
Oh.
So rather than being a compliment, it derived from a word that meant wile or trick. And around 1400 it came to take on other meanings like admirable, fine, acceptable, honourable. And when it was applied to people, it was applied to males, and the more specific female, fair, attractive, followed shortly behind. So actually it's something of an insult in the modern sense, in that it falls short of a compliment. So if somebody calls you pretty clever, they mean less than clever, strictly speaking. So yeah, I thought that was quite fun.
Okay, as I said earlier, our theme this week is the therapeutic benefits of reading. And this came to me because of an article that I read in an article I read in an in-flight magazine a few months ago about a very unusual bookshop in Florence, in Italy. And then I read another article about a young woman who said that reading had helped her overcome anorexia nervosa. So all of this got me thinking. Sorry, I need to rustle pages. I'll just get rid of that. Having read about Piccola Farmacia Letteraria, the bookshop in Florence, I found it very difficult to actually research it because everything about it on the internet is in Italian. But I have a very lovely Italian friend, Gabriella Capiletti, and we went for a coffee together. Picture the scene. We're looking at videos and Italian newspaper articles on the internet, which Gabriella is translating from Italian to Greek, and I'm making notes in English. So this may be full of errors and so on. But what I discovered, that the Piccola Farmacia Letteraria was founded in Florence by 35-year-old Elena Molini. And what the bookshop does is they prescribe books to help with emotional problems. So it's like a chemist shop or a pharmacy where you can go and ask for advice. And it's worth looking at the videos, even if you don't speak Italian, because you'll see each book has a beautiful card label attached. And this label has a prescription of dosages and possible side effects as well. And we're talking about books of fiction, not self-help books. So in the video, we saw people being recommended Donna Tartt, Gabriel Garcia Marquez, various books which were deemed to be helpful with whatever spiritual or emotional ailment they were presenting. So on the video, we saw customers asking for recommendations for friends with problems. One said, and for themselves, "I don't feel like reading. Give me something light and funny." Another wanted a book with a strong female role model to inspire her. But the whole idea of the bookshop springs from the belief that a book can cure a person. Are you sad? Has a love affair ended disastrously? Are you going through a difficult time in your life? We can recommend books for all these occasions, is a rough translation of one of their videos. One Italian newspaper article describes it as a small corner of wellness, a bookshop where you can find a cure, literary, of course, for every disease. Elena has a background in publishing, and she got the idea from her observation that she believes that 90% of people choose books depending on their emotional state or are buying gifts for friends needing emotional support. And I did email the Piccola Farmacia Letteraria in English, obviously, and explained that I would like to know something about it, but I don't read or speak Italian. And I did get a response from Chiara at the bookshop with their little sort of press release in English, very short. But it says, "Piccola Farmacia Letteraria is an independent and resourceful bookstore based in Florence with a brand new method to arrange books. Our project is based on a very simple question. How do you feel today? With our team of psychologists, we examine the books, and as in a real pharmacy, we create a package leaflet and give it to the readers, accompanied by recommendations about dosage and warnings about side effects. Mm-hmm. We select a variety of books for different kinds of discomfort that we can diagnose and take care of. There is always a literary solution for real-life problems." So what struck me there is the team of psychologists,
right?
But also that you really need in-depth knowledge of the books if you're going to recommend it for something. So I thought that was fascinating. I wonder if anybody will be replicating that in other parts of the world. It's a bit of fun, really. I suppose it's what in business might be called a USP, a unique selling point. You know that they do that, but it's getting a lot of attention in the press in the Italian.
I would love to go there. Wouldn't that be interesting to go and if they have anything in English? But I think that's such a clever idea, and I love the idea of side effects and dosages and warnings about those things.
Yeah, because the thing is, people's responses to books are quite individual.
They are,
and you know what one person finds uplifting, uh-huh. entertaining, amusing, whatever somebody else might completely
not get it. Yes. It is, but I think it's interesting, the idea that you go into a bookshop and you have a conversation and you sort of get the customer and the bookseller get to know each other in that time, you know, and maybe that influences their recommendations. The other interesting thing that I found was on the BBC, on BBC World, they have a strand called Textual Healing. So at Textual Healing, there are some interesting video clips you can watch, and I'll share the links later. They also have an agony aunt with the glorious name Hepzibah Anderson, who suggests bibliotherapy for different emotional problems. And I read a few of the letters, and I'll just abbreviate the letters and her response. I won't go into all of them. But in a response to a woman grieving the loss of her twin sister, Hepzibah says, "Give sorrow words. The grief that does not speak whispers the o'erfraught heart and bids it break," quoting Shakespeare, of course. "As well as giving your sorrow words, a good book will take you out of yourself for a few hours, even as the plight of its characters might remind you that others have gone through similar ordeals. Just knowing that and feeling less alone will make you stronger." And again, I'm skipping a few paragraphs of her advice. "So, crucial though it is to be gentle with yourself, you must be patient too. Think about setting modest goals that will allow you to make measurable progress, no matter how slight. You might start by picking up a collection of verse and making a deal with yourself to find time to sit quietly, empty your mind as much as you can, and read just one poem a day. Poems of mourning could be just the book. There's joy to be had from simply holding it in your hands," because she said it's a very beautiful book. "But open it and you'll find language whose musicality and sheer loveliness is transcendent. Ben Jonson pines for his lost son." That's a poem I know, very short and very poignant. "Wilfred Owen commemorates comrades lost in battle, and W.H. Auden sings the funeral blues. As these pages reveal, there is no right or wrong way to go about the grieving process. Tennyson's melancholy is black and Walt Whitman's radiant, while Christina Rossetti reaches a place of resignation." And then she also suggests The Goldfinch, which we talked about last week, a novel that begins with a boy losing his mother. "So while there's nothing escapist about the story that unfolds, its grip is utterly unremitting. If ever there's a book to draw you out of yourself and remind you of the special pleasure of reading, this is it." She had another letter, apparently from a 10th grade girl. I mean, I don't know if these letters are real, but I'll read it. You know, you can judge for yourself. "Unrequited love is not the only issue that 10th grade girls like me go through, though it is pertinent. I am an avid reader with a love for modern teen fiction as well as 17th, 18th and 19th century historical fiction. I have close friends and quite an obsession for a certain 12th grade boy who barely notices me. Please recommend some literature that I would enjoy." And Hepzibah says, "You never get close enough to that icy beauty or 12th grade boy to discover their disillusioning flaws, that they're really very self-absorbed or don't share your enthusiasm for good books. Unrequited love is idealised love. It will, by definition, never be subjected to the strains of ho-hum reality." So in a way, she says to this girl, enjoy it for what it is. Mm-hmm. It's a delicious pain, if you like.
Does she recommend a book for that?
Going on, she does. Okay. Yeah, she does. So I recommend Catherine Heine's new short story collection, Single Carefree Mellow, which brings love down to earth with a wry bump. Oh. Even its depictions of illicit extramarital amour are anchored in the domestic. There's one particular story, How to Give the Wrong Impression, which is told in the second person singular and describes a girl who's in love with her roommate Boris. Boris loves her back, but just not like that, and he's forever demonstrating. For instance, he gives her a Christmas present of a framed poster of the four major food groups. You can't think of anything less romantic, can you? So that tells them. She also suggests philosopher Alain de Botton's classic On Love, a charming first novel charting the course of romance from couples meeting on a Paris to London flight, his hatred of her taste in shoes and her eventual drift away. As primers on the do's and don'ts of courtship go, this one's a treat and only mildly neurotic. And finally, to stop you becoming too cynical too young,
Save Dorothy Parker for College. Two great novels to keep you believing in romance while you wait for your would-be paramours to grow up. Rose Tremaine's Music and Silence, set in Copenhagen in the 17th century. And A.S. Byatt's Possession, twins the mystery of a forgotten romance between two Victorian authors and a stuttering modern-day relationship that springs up between two rival literary critics and accidental sleuths. Okay. So fixated are they on their reading, they almost fail to notice one another. And there are lots more of those. But what struck me is that she actually really gives a serious answer and sound advice, really, as well as recommending books.
Yeah. What, talking about the, going back to the Italian bookshop, the name of which I'm not even going to attempt
I practiced with Gabrielle and it's still not that good.
It just reminded me a little bit of how librarians used to be. You know, when I was a teenager, I had a Saturday job in the library. And not to the same scale, but, you know, people would come and they would want a particular type of book and they wanted advice. And it was when you said about, you know, developing a relationship between the bookseller and the customer. And that's what librarians did, really.
Yeah.
They would know, oh, here's Mrs. So-and-so, she likes a nice Mills and Boone.
Yes,
this kind of thing.
Mr. Amazon does that, though, because I've got a Kindle and you download, you know, because you read this, you might like this.
Yes. and sometimes they get it right, and quite often they don't, because you think, no, I bought that for a present. Yes. I wouldn't read it if you paid me.
That's right,
So, can you guys think of any occasion when a book has helped you through a difficult time in your life or given you some hope?
Well, I thought about this a lot because I've on occasion suffered with depression. And one of the things that, when I realise it's happening to me, is when I can't read. So I try to read and I'm distracted very easily. Right. So not a particular novel but just the sheer act of making myself or reading helps.
Right.
So it actually makes me concentrate and, you know, so there's lots of things I have read in that situation, but I couldn't think of any particular novel. Mm. It was just the actual act of reading. Mm. I think just immersing yourself in a book, whatever it is, for me, really gets me through.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I think as well, I can't think of any particular book, but just reading itself is a therapy, isn't it? Yeah. It's an escape. Which is a bit of a cliche, but it's also an escape that involves your mind and your emotions and makes you work as well.
Mm. Yeah, which takes you. I mean, I think I struggled with that question and thought I couldn't think of anything specific. But I suppose times when there's been too much going on and you're under, you know, you're stressed or under pressure, and you want to stop your brain thinking about whatever the problems are, then I think sort of try and it's like you sort of try and get into a book, and a good book will sort of, like you say, take you in and take you away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. I've thought of some books that helped during the time when my late husband died and was terrible traumatic experience, and but. I can't, they're not fiction. So, I mean, like Thich Nhat Hanh, some of his books, the Buddhist monk, some of his books were very helpful in just helping me to calm and to look at things in a way that that made it much easier to bear.
Mm-hmm.
And and another book that helped me, although not fiction, was Joan Didion's The Year of Magical Thinking. And she wrote that about when she lost a loved one and how she was affected. Kind of things like that kind of help you, like, I'm not alone, although you know you're not alone. But it's interesting to read about someone else's reaction and the way they handled it, etc.
Yeah, when you think, you know, no one's ever been through this, I can't bear it, and then you realize actually, you know, people are going through it, people do go through it, and people do cope, and it can help you give you the strength, I think. Yeah.
And in those bad times, like Heather was describing, if you're depressed or whatever, I sometimes like to read about people who are depressed and are in the same situation. Mm. If I can force myself to open the book and get.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I remember A Girl Interrupted, and another was Rachel at the Wedding, which was about people who were having bizarre moods. And I like to read things like that because it takes me out of myself. As I said, you can get yourself to open a book when you're in that kind of state of mind.
Yeah.
They are very helpful books, therapeutic reading, if, as I said, you can read, which sometimes is a problem, so maybe audio books might be a good thing.
Yes, yeah, I suppose it's more passive, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, you can, even if you're feeling depressed, you maybe could just put that on. Mm. So, and has a book ever inspired you to make changes in your life?
No. Silence.
That's okay. I don't think so.
Well, I think the books I just mentioned, as far as the change in my life, it didn't really change my life, I guess, but it changed that particular mood. It would help to pull me out of the depression kind of and say, oh, get on with it, at looking at these erratic behaviors, etc.
I think the only thing I can think is going back to like 70s, 70s, early 80s, and some of the feminist fiction.
Yeah.
Which didn't necessarily change anything. It just
reinforced.
Kind of reinforced feelings and ideas that were sort of developing.
Yeah,
anyway.
I think a lot of those books had a big impact.
Women's Room.
It gave you some validation, some strength to make changes. Yeah. Yeah.
I remember that I had forgotten that The Women's Room by Marilynne Robinson was
French.
At a time. Huh?
Marilynne French.
Marilynne French, thank you. The Women's Room by Marilynne French was just fabulous for me at a time in my life when I was in a marriage that was not going very well. In fact, was close to the end at that point, and I wonder if that influenced it, because reading that was really powerful for me at that time.
And it could help you to make a step that you knew you needed to make.
Yes.
But I think again just about reading, and I can remember being a fairly young teenager, and for some reason we got a few of the Bobsey twins books. I don't know where they came from, and probably for the first time I read for pleasure, and that was the start of wanting to read and wanting to read other things and wanting to read more. Before that we didn't really have, you know, my parents didn't particularly read. You know, there weren't very many novels around, and so I started then to collect things and moved on. And, you know, I think a few weeks ago when we talked about Dennis Wheatley and people like that, you know, I tried all the different genres
at the
time.
It's almost a rite of passage.
Yes, yes, that's right. But it kind of opened the door, it made me realise that, you know, the books made me feel good.
Can
a book have a negative effect on your mood then?
Yes, one jumped into my mind straight away, and it's Patricia Cornwell. She wrote about Jack the Ripper, and it's supposedly fact, and it was, sorry if she's listening, I thought it was absolute rubbish, and she blamed this poor artist called Walter Sickert, and she directly said that it was him, and talked about his deformities and all sorts of things about his life, and I got so cross. Because, you know, maybe there was some research there that could have been, but it was just
and
awful.
He can't defend himself.
He died however many years ago, ago.
Yeah. You know, and I think that has been well and truly debunked.
It made me so angry.
Why are you defending Jack the Ripper?
it was defending this poor man who died, you know. Goodness,
it was a very flawed thesis, I think.
There was a bit of circumstantial, you know, sort of he was maybe at the time he was around and, you know, things were not good. But, you know, it really kind of pulled him apart and almost destroyed his character. And it was awful.
Nicola answered the question and she said, yes, I deliberately avoid Mills and Boone and Chick Lit or even holiday reading type romances, as I think they set up dangerous expectations of what life is like for young women.
Uh-huh.
So
Yeah. There's also a set of books that perhaps we shouldn't mention that lots of young people did read, and they're going to be in for a big disappointment as they get older.
Well, how on earth can you possibly not mention the books after that?
The grey books.
Oh, those books. Yeah.
I thought it was all old women that read that.
Oh, I haven't read that.
No.
I don't intend to.
I didn't bother.
From what I've heard about
it's,
it.
It was chosen for a book club, mm-hmm. So I started it, but I got bored of it very quickly. It's poorly written, apart from anything else.
Catherine and I went to Mallorca on holiday, and virtually everybody around the pool in this hotel, including young people, were reading the book. Yeah. It was amazing to see.
Isn't some of the charity bookshops have asked people not to give them any more copies because obviously it sold a lot of copies, but nobody wants them. Nobody wants to keep them, and the charity shops can't sell them. Well, given that we've been talking about the healing power of story, what are the implications for writers? Are there any?
Well, I think there are, because so many of us, if we're, you know, we write about things that are troubling, things, obstacles that come up in the books and how they are resolved. Growth, especially in the coming of age novel, is growth of the character, character who kind of sees the light at some point. So I think, I don't know, I think that might apply.
I think it raises the issue of responsibility as a writer to be truthful, to create, create's not the right word, but to be truthful to, in fiction, but to write, it's not realistically, it is to write truthfully.
With honest. Authenticity.
To be honest.
I think it raises the issue of the writer's responsibility to write the truth, to write truthfully and to be authentic. Because the fact that, because readers may be sort of reading your work and in a dark place maybe, and you owe it to them.
But it doesn't mean we always have to be upbeat or make everything
not at all.
A happy ending.
No, not at all.
It's just aware that there are readers and that they may be on an emotional journey.
Right.
Yeah. Well, my husband never understands, but I do sometimes quite like reading something that's incredibly sad and having a really good cry. He always says, why would you put yourself through that? That you'd make you cry. But I actually sometimes quite enjoy that.
Yes. Right. Yes, I think, it can be therapeutic and it's
cathartic.
It's almost like rehearsing, because in this, say, there's a death or, the tragic events in the fictional world, it allows you to express those feelings without actually having a personal loss.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. That's true.
It's nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Heather and Amy Lee Tempest to share their reading with us. Heather, what's on your bedside table?
Well, I'm really, really excited. I've got Adam Kay's new book, 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, and Adam Kay was a junior doctor in the UK, and his last book, This Is Going to Hurt, was absolutely hilarious and moving, and he takes it from his diaries as a junior doctor and the things that happened, and for me, having worked in the health service for 40 odd years, it was hysterical. I know some people didn't find it as funny, but he's just written the new one and it's just been released, and so it's waiting for me to start. I did read that he's doing a stage performance, and I wanted to try and get tickets to see him in December. By the time I found out about it, all the tickets have gone. Oh. So Buxton's fully booked. But I'm really excited to sit down and read it.
Lovely.
I read his last book, so I'll be looking for this one.
Yes.
So now let's hear from Amy.
I have my Kindle on the bedside table, and my latest buy, the book I'm reading at the moment, is by a poet called Brian Bilston. And I came across him through Facebook, actually. A few friends or some pages I were following were regularly sharing his poetry. And every time I laughed or for how clever they were, or they just made me feel really good. So it's like witty wordplay. It's just really clever stuff and amusing. And it's just really light and easy to get into. And I'd wanted to buy it for, well, since it came out maybe a month ago or a couple of weeks ago, I wanted to buy it. But I was a bit skint at that time. But then I saw something on Facebook saying for this month only you could get a download for 99p. So I just was all over it straight away. So I'm about a quarter of the way through it. Interestingly, it's not what I expected. It's not a book of just poetry. It's called A Diary of Somebody. And it's a guy who's decided to write a poem every day. So you have the poems each day, but you also have a narrative of the story of the character. And he speaks about why he wrote that poem. So it is like, it's a poetry book, but it's also a novel, a storybook as well. So it's really interesting.
Well, thank you, Amy. Interesting, isn't it?
To know
how somebody can make a successful or become a published author through the internet, through being an internet sensation. Sadly, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe on Radio Public, iTunes or Stitcher so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a 5-star review or drop by our Facebook group and introduce yourself. Keep sharing the love by introducing a friend to Write Club, the podcast. Goodbye.
Bye.